all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Buttress, host of Southern Remedies, Relatively Speaking. Join the conversation every Tuesday at 11 as we dissect issues that are important to you and your family. That's Relatively Speaking, Tuesdays only on MPB Think Radio.
Good morning. This is Dr. Jimmy Stewart, and this is Southern Remedy from MPB Think Radio. This is the program where you can call in with any type of medical question about any issue that you might be having, whether that's a new symptom, maybe a new medication, maybe a side effect from something you're already taking, or maybe just any general preventive questions. Whatever those questions may be, you can always email us. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. Well, a good morning to you if you're joining us live. It is nasty weather out there, so please be careful. We talk a lot about that during bad weather situations just because that is such a big risk, particularly motor vehicular collisions and other accidents that might happen. We call them accidents, but a lot of times we can prevent that with a lot of good safety issues, just maybe mainly taking your time and not doing things of taking risk, like going through water you can't see. Certainly, we've got a lot of areas with particularly low-lying areas with flash flooding right now. Lots of trees down. Certainly, we've got a lot of dead trees from last summer from the drought, and now sort of predictably a lot of those are coming down. But even if they're not, you know, there's a lot of potential risk. If you see a power line on the ground, please do not go near that and notify Entergy or anybody else that might need to come and check that out. So just everybody stay safe out there, that there's a lot of potential risk right now, and stay tuned. We may be giving you some updates throughout the hour as they become available about the weather risk. Well, this is Southern Remedy, and I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart. I'm answering your questions right now. You can call us by dialing 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. Let's go to William from Petal. Good morning, William.
Hey, morning, Dr. Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had several questions about if you have type 2 diabetes by
yeah.
This
okay.
is what I heard many years ago. They got harvested natural insulin from horses. And I don't want, I believe that's still true. They used to. But what is insulin nowadays for somebody with type 2 diabetes? Is it some kind of chemical makeup, or what is it?
Yeah, so insulin is a hormone that the body produces, and your pancreas produces it. And your pancreas is really good at doing that until it sort of quits, or if there's resistance to that. And therefore, there's two different types of diabetes. Type 1 is when you don't make enough insulin. Type 2 is when there's resistance. And sometimes we do treat that with more insulin that give it to the body. So that hormone is made by an organ called the pancreas, which sits right behind your stomach, and it also helps to break down food when you eat it. So it has sort of a dual role there, and it has a couple other hormones that it uses, that it secretes to help regulate blood sugar in your body. So you definitely need that to live, because basically what happens is you break down sugars and you absorb them into your bloodstream. Those need to go out to all the tissues. So there's a receptor, a little signaling receptor on every cell where insulin goes up to it and it says, hey, this glucose is floating around. As soon as I stimulate you as a cell, that glucose can go inside the cell. And it was a really medical breakthrough when they made it. I don't know exactly timeline-wise, but I want to say maybe 50s. It might even be like, you know, longer than that, but 1950s maybe, but a good long time that they used either porcine or human insulins that were sort of put together to treat patients. Of course, there's a lot of problems with that. Number one is sort of the purification of those. And number two, you can get other substances with that. So particularly if it's, you know, if you think about blood transfusions would be a good sort of rough analogy. If you get the wrong type of blood or in transplant now, we know there's lots of different things in different cells of different people that if you're exposed to it, you can reject that. So that was a lot of the problems had to do with the purification of that. And of course, who's going to donate that? So how do you get those substances to begin with? And it was very costly to do it that way. So in an attempt to say, hey, really, it's about the insulin molecule, right? So let's just replicate that. So they were able to chemically make the insulin molecule to break it down and say, okay, what does this look like? And then it was short acting because that's in our bodies. That's what insulin does, is it that pancreas continually secretes insulin. It's not like it stops at any one time. There's a basal rate that's there. And then when you eat, you need more insulin. So it is stimulated to spit out more insulin. So the first time they made a synthetic insulin, it did get over some of those hurdles of, you know, all the other impurities and stuff like that in trying to get it. And it was widely available, but it was short acting. So you had to take it multiple times a day. And the only way to get it is to inject it into your underneath your skin. And then they were able to develop a way to have a long acting insulin. So they said, hey, is there a way that we can make this last a lot longer? So nowadays we have a lot of different insulins at our disposal and that we can use. And typically most people are on a long acting or basal insulin that they get all the time. And then they may have, if they're using it, they may have additional times of the day that they inject it, particularly before meals. And now there's also a pump that fits underneath the skin, and the needle stays there for long periods of time, and it delivers you. It's a little device that you put on your belt, and basically it delivers insulin based on when you need it. And one step further than that, there is something called a continuous blood glucose device, which you may have seen this, that sort of looks like a little device that's taped to somebody's arm or their leg or their side. And it stays on there and it monitors the blood sugar levels, sends a signal either to the person about what those are and or the device that is injecting the insulin into their system. So it sort of mimics what that pancreas is doing. So that's sort of the lowdown on where we are now. We really aren't looking to go back to pooling human insulin just because, again, of all the risk with that when we have good ways to make it. I know from time to time, whoever is making the insulin that people need, you know, they may have some shortages there. But other than that, it's really the better way to deliver it, and particularly with some of the longer-acting insulins. One more thing on this. Not everybody with type 2 diabetes needs insulin, so because your body's making enough insulin, particularly early on in the diagnosis, it's an easy way to treat it by giving more insulin on top of that to overcome that resistance. But there's other medications that act on, say, the liver to inhibit blood glucose formation and, you know, those kinds of things. So there's some other alternatives, too. Not everybody who has type 2 diabetes will need to be treated with insulin. But great question, though.
All right, Dr. Jimmy, all right, all insulin nowadays is a synthetic hormone that they make up chemically. All right, so if your body is a type, you got type 2 diabetes, and your body's making that insulin,
right?
You're not using it correctly according to other problems that you have. All right, if you start taking this synthetic insulin and your body is rejecting the amount of insulin that it makes, would it reject the new insulin that you're injecting into your body?
Yeah, it doesn't really reject both, it doesn't reject the insulin you're making. It doesn't reject the insulin that you're getting. It's your body's just not able to keep up. So that's really a good way to think about it. So in type 2 diabetes, your pancreas is still making insulin, but it just can't make enough to keep up with that resistance. And usually that's because of excess, you know, fat over time, and sometimes there are some genetics at play in that. But yeah, it doesn't reject the insulin. You just don't have enough in your system, and the way it works in the body, it doesn't even distinguish between your own insulin that you're making or any insulin that we give you.
Jimmy, one more quick question.
Uh-huh.
All right. Ozempic, is that a synthetic insulin?
Yeah, Ozempic's a little bit different. So it acts in a different way on a different hormonal system to lower glucose levels and also decrease how fast you absorb food. So it sort of slows things down. That's the biggest part. That's one of the main ways that it decreases your appetite. But it's not an insulin. It's not insulin. It doesn't work on that same system. It's a really complex system of hormones. There are things called incretins. There's glucagon that does sort of the opposite of insulin. So there's all kinds of different checks and balances in that system.
Well, Dr. Jimmy, there are some medicines, and Ozempic is one of them, that, and like tablets and all that you take, and other types of pills, that it has got severe warnings about giving you pancreas problems, saying severe pancreas problems, and if you've ever had pancreatitis, that you're not supposed to take them.
Would this, yep, that's right.
Synthetic insulin do the same side effects?
No. Insulins don't have that same risk. Now, you're right. There are some medications, just like all medications, have some precautions on there that are listed. And things like Ozempic, they do have a very small, but it is a risk, an additional risk of pancreatic problems. But insulin that you take doesn't have that. It's not really an issue with that.
All right, Dr. Jimmy, thanks for letting me take up all your time.
Oh, it's your time.
You're doing a wonderful job.
No, thank you so much, William. Welcome back to Southern Remedy. I'm Dr. Jimmy with you this morning, answering your questions about any kind of healthcare topic that you might be interested in. Just a reminder, probably predictable on a stormy day like this. We are glad people are with us and listening and calling in. But if you're on the line, just hold on. We will get to you as soon as we can. Let's go to Robbie from Kosciuszko. Good morning, Robbie.
Good morning, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. In a few months, I'll be 67. About 7 years ago, I was diagnosed with BPH. In January of this year, PSA was 2.14 on a scale of 0 to 4, which I'm guessing is good. I don't really know.
Yes. So, you know, that PSA is used for a couple of different things. Number one is a not-so-good screening for prostate cancer, unless it's really, really high. It is sometimes used to monitor treatment of prostate cancer. And then the other one is to look and sort of see if it correlates with BPH. And that one is more variable. Like that range, and that's about the normal range that is given on most labs, in most places, is 0 to 4. But it is age specific. So as you get older, if you're, say, an 80-year-old and you have a PSA of 6, that's really not that uncommon. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have prostate cancer. Really, that was probably a screen. I'm guessing it was a screening lab that they did just to make sure it wasn't 20 or, you know, really high. But yeah, that sounds like that's in the usual range for your age, and they would probably go off of symptoms more than anything else on treatment of that.
Okay. In the morning, I take at 7 o'clock, I take 5 milligrams of finasteride. Mm-hmm. At 7 at night, I take 5 milligrams of tadalafil, and I also take 320 milligrams of saw palmetto. But yep. I'm up every hour on the hour to go to the bathroom. I was talking with my pharmacist here in Cusco, and he said that his father had the same problem, and he went on a medicine called TamSecure. I'm not sure if that's a Spanish word. I tried to get an English spelling of it, but the dosage is 0.4 milligram. And he said his father went from getting up every hour on the hour to maybe once at night.
Yeah, that sounds like Tamsulosin, which is I'm not sure which country manufactures that, but it is a medication that's available here in the United States. It goes under the trade name Flomax, sort of trendy name for BPH. But yeah, that's Tamsulosin. That's the dose too, is 0.4. So I'm guessing that's what that is. But you'd need a prescription for that. But it is another medication class that is useful in the treatment of BPH and some of the symptoms that you're having. And you might just want to talk to your doctor about that, just to see if you can try it. I've got some patients on it and they do well. So most of the time, most of them are on it twice a day. But the other treatments that you're taking are also sort of hit different systems. The other thing to keep in mind is it is a frustrating thing to treat, because that prostate tissue, once it gets so big, it takes a long time to shrink it back down. And in particular with both the Flomax and the finasteride, it may take, you know, weeks to months before you see a significant drop down. So it is sort of a frustrating thing. And sometimes we forget to tell people that, hey, this is probably going to work at least a little bit, but it may take a long time to do that.
Do you think I could add Flomax to my regimen?
Yeah, or substitute one. So it really would be up to to your physician just to decide which of those might be better. But I think that would be something to talk about, either adding to the finasteride and to the tadalafil. And salt palmetto is fine to take on the side. A lot of people do that to try to prevent BPH. Not a whole lot of data to say that it does, but that's one of those things that I tell people, hey, it's got a really good therapeutic profile. It's not going to cause a lot of problems. But yeah, I'd call your doctor up that's prescribing those other ones and say, hey, still having problems. I'm interested in Flomax or Tamsulosin. Do you think that would be an option for me?
Okay. The only side effect I read about the Flomax was that it can cause semen to back up in the bladder. Is that bad?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that part. What did you say now?
The only side effect that I read about the Flomax was that it can cause semen to back up into your bladder.
Oh, yeah. It can cause retrograde ejaculation and not really a problem. Most people don't even know that that's happening. So that shouldn't be a problem. Another side effect of it in some patients is it does cause a little bit of a decrease in blood pressure. So you sort of have to monitor that. But other than those, most of the time it's pretty well tolerated.
Okay. If I do get on it, should I take it at night or in the morning?
Well, most patients take it twice a day. But if you're only taking it once a day, it's probably at night.
Yeah, okay. Quick, if you have time, I did an old school INO a week ago, and from 7 at night to 10 at night, I drank 3 ounces of water. During my sleep, when I get up to go to the bathroom, I take a sip, and that winds up being a total of 4 ounces. But through the night, I've voided 7 cups of urine. And I only drink 2 cups of coffee in the morning, and then I drink water the rest of the day. Does that seem abnormal?
No, that's about right. You have to keep in mind, too, I mean, you need enough water, throughout the day. So you're going to need about anywhere from at least 1.5 to 2 liters, and if you're active, more than that a day. Now, when you do it, sequencing it so that you're doing more of it during the daytime, that's smart what you're doing right there. But keep in mind that if your bladder's not completely emptying, you still have a significant amount of urine in it, and it may not be related totally. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I didn't realize that there was still urine that much in the bladder.
Yeah, because what's happening is that prostate is preventing it from completely emptying. So it'll empty a little bit, but it's the pressure, when the pressure gets high enough, it can overcome that prostate size and pressure on the urethra. to let that out, but it's not going to fully empty most of the time. And that's why you have to keep going, just because you don't ever fully empty your bladder.
Oh, okay, okay. The thing that concerns me is that it affects my REM sleep. I sleep, but I don't get rested.
Yeah, because you're up. Yeah. It can do it. It can be a hassle on your sleep for sure. But call your doctor about the Tamsulosin and say, hey, is this something else I can take with this or in place of to try to see if I can get a little bit quicker a response with it.
Okay, just one last thing. Are you familiar with hypnosis for chronic pain?
Yeah, I know it's been studied, and along with a lot of other non-medical things, and a lot of it, actually, it's been most useful for in addiction therapy. I know a lot of patients, particularly for smoking cessation, have done that. I'm not aware of how much evidence there is with chronic pain, but I would imagine it could help out. You know, it's worth a try if you're having, you know, for somebody who's having chronic pain problems.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for the information. Have a good day and stay safe.
Okay, you too. Thank you for listening and calling. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy with you on this stormy day. Hoping everybody is staying safe out there. Let's go to David from Horn Lake. Good morning, David.
Thank you for taking my call. I got a question for you. I worked for 26 years for a Fortune 500 chemical company. During my workplace, workplace exposure, I've been exposed to benzyl chloride, methyl chloride, acrylonitrile, nickel catalyst, asbestos, plastic processing, metal stearates, formaldehyde, glycerin, fatty acids, fatty amides, and fatty amines and whatnot. And a lot of the stuff caused nasal and lung cancer and caused cancer and stuff and whatnot. Scuttlebutt was that once you got retirement age, you didn't live too much longer. So I'm fixing to go to my first Medicare wellness assessment type deal. I wrote to the new Medicare. My question to you is there a, do you know of a, since I'm at an elevated risk for cancers, is there a specific doctor or specific test I should request? And do you know if there's a federally funded worker health screening program? I know they have one for coal miners for black lung disease. Do you know of anything about a federal program for workers' workplace exposure to toxic and chemicals?
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there. So real quickly, I think the best person for you to see would be a type of doctor called an occupational health physician. And they are trained to really look through these issues. Basically, it's going to take going through each one of those chemicals or substances that you had a possible exposure to, and then seeing what the potential things are, and then designing a screening for all of those based on that. So some things may be more appropriate. You know, for instance, for our coal miners, that were exposed to coal dust, silicosis, and those kinds of things that might affect their lungs. Lung-specific screening would be the one of the main things to do. Some of those chemicals you listed, I think, are, you know, some of the cancers are located in different parts of the body, so it may be a little bit different. But an occupational health physician is the person to see. And I, you know, you'd sort of have to just search. I don't know off the top of my head if there would be somebody regionally that would be the person to go to, at least to give you a once over and say, okay, here's the possibilities, the design, you know, it's pretty much design that screening program around that. And then from there, you know, from your question about, is there any kind of support for this? I don't know. It would depend on, you know, individual situations. But again, I think that occupational health physician would be up to date on that and could look that information up and say, hey, here's some assistance in this area, or here's some for another area. It would just really depend on the type, you know, of type of legislation that would support that. And there may be some things outside the government too that would be good resources for you. But that's what I would say. You know, this is sort of broad suggestion for or recommendation for anybody that has any kind of exposures to anything, whether that would be, smoking or, we have very specific things for each one of those. But in this case, with all those chemicals, and it was a list of them that you got, I think somebody would have to go through there one by one, look at the material safety data sheets and say, okay, like what is the potential side effects of these and risk of those, and then design a screening for that for you in particular.
All right, thanks so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. The number to call if you have a question is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. You can always email us. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. Let's go to Susan from Memphis.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
I have macular degeneration, and my retina doctor says I cannot have cataract surgery. The cataract surgeon says that only 1 out of 1,000 surgeries leads to blindness, and I wanted to get your opinion.
Yeah, so different ophthalmologists are going to have a little bit different opinions. That may sound like a very low risk. But the comfort level of your surgeon and ophthalmologist, really at heart are surgeons, is going to have to be, some people are much more comfortable with that 1% risk, and maybe that's all they do, and they feel comfortable managing any kind of complication. Some other ophthalmologists may not feel that comfortable. So I would say I would get another opinion it sounds like you're really trying to, move in that direction and want to know what the true risk is, and just to sort of see if there's somebody else that might give you a second opinion. If two ophthalmologists who that's sort of their expertise, if they tell you that, I probably would go with what they said.
Yeah. Okay. You mean a macular degeneration doctor or a cataract doctor?
I probably would say some
opinion from.
Yeah, probably. You could go both ways with that, but I'm guessing the person you talked to is the person who's treating you for the macular degeneration, right?
I've talked to both. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So
the cataract doctor said it happens once out of every 1,000 surgeries he does.
Yeah. Yeah. I you're going to have to sort of balance that out. But if you're talking to the person who's taking the cataract out, I think that's the direction I would go in, and that is a risk. I mean, sometimes you just have to weigh the risk out and say, I'm having such decreased visual loss in that one eye versus losing total vision in that eye. This is sort of a risk you have to take.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Good luck to you, and thank you for calling. All right. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. The number to call is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. Let's go to Tom from Brandon. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Dr. Jimmy. I'm in my late 70s, and there are times when I feel like my body is just disintegrating. For instance, when I do trim the shrubs, I don't realize it's happening, but when I come out, I look like I've been, my forearms and my lower legs look like I've been in a knife fight. But that and unexpected little pains, aches and pains that show up. In this case, I tell my friends sometimes, I think originally it must have been termed the olden years, and some smart aleck went ahead and put a G in front. But
go ahead.
But anyhow, I last Friday, I did my normal, went to the gym, and then I did my errands, grocery shopping, and went by the nursery to buy some spring plants. And when I got home, I had this pain just under my right breast. I played golf that weekend, and the first day I could feel it, but it wasn't that I couldn't swing. The second day it was much better. But when I leaned over, that's when I could feel the pain, and I could touch that area and feel the pain. So So rather than go to a trip to the doctor, I thought maybe you could help me diagnose what that might be.
Yeah, if it was all those, I hear that a lot in my own patients, you know, and certainly you've got a lot more fragility with your skin as you get older. Unfortunately, there's not much to do about that besides, you know, wearing longer sleeve shirts and when you're out working and that kind of thing. And sometimes the medications we're on can, you know, make you bleed a little bit more easier and not clot those little vessels on the skin. And then the capillaries themselves are fragile. So that part of it, that sounds like something you may have to sort of to deal with. But yeah, the pain that you're describing, to me, that sounds like more muscular pain in your chest. Certainly if you're swinging a golf club, even if it doesn't seem like you did anything out of the ordinary, there's a chance that you had a little micro tear in the pectoralis major is the main muscle. There's one that's below that. And then, of course, there's muscles in between the ribs, all the way around your rib cage. Those are the intercostal muscles. So it could be any one of those. Typically, those would take about a week or two to get better. They tend to be positional, so leaning forward or in any direction, if it's worse than that, that's probably because you're just putting a little bit more pressure or tension on that muscle. And then what we call localized pain of actually pushing on it, so when you put your hand over it and push down, it hurts. All that together, I would say this is probably not your heart, not your lungs. There are some types of inflammation, particularly in the sac, it's called the pericardium around your heart. It tends to be positional with pain, but you're not going to be able to push on your chest and reproduce that. So I don't think that's what's going on. It doesn't sound like it's something from your lungs or the coverings around the lungs either. So if I had to place my money on it, I'd say it's probably related to a small muscular strain or tear. You know, we say strains and sprains, but basically it's a little tearing of the muscle fibers. And that takes a little bit of time to heal up, say a week or two. If you're able to take something for the pain over the counter that's not going to interfere with anything else, like ibuprofen or acetaminophen, Tylenol, then I think that's fine to take. Now, in the chest, I have some patients that have a hard time with it just because you can't really rest those muscles as well. It's not like you can quit breathing for a week. I would just sort of limit what you're doing, though, with your arms. I know I may be cutting into your golf game, but maybe taking a break from that for about a week just to have this some time to heal up. If it's still hurting after that, at that point I'd go to the physician. Some physicians now have an ultrasound in their office, and they can oftentimes do an ultrasound over that area to see the actual muscle fiber tears or the inflammation that's related to that around the muscle. So that may be something to get checked out, but I'd probably give it about another week.
Okay. Well, fortunately, this week I can't play golf anyway because of the weather. But
that's right.
I think at the gym they have a trunk twist machine that I use, but I don't remember having any pain after that. But I think at the nursery I may have picked up a bag of soil without squatting properly and just leaned over and picked it up. And I think it's probably in my rib cage that I have a minor tear, as you described it. So obviously I'll be resting this week from the golf game. So hopefully
it will
be fine by the weekend.
Yeah. I think most of the time those heal up within a week to 10 days. So I just give it a little bit of rest as best you can. And you're right. I think today, if you hit the ball, went out and played, it would be probably more aches and pains for you with hitting through all the soggy ground. So,
exactly.
Yeah. All right, Tom. I appreciate
you.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you calling and listening. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy with you this morning on this rainy, stormy day. Hope everybody's taking some safety measures to stay put where you are and try to deal with things. I have some good friends that had a lot of trees down, and certainly I would not attempt to really get all this stuff out. I know sometimes you just got to move some stuff to to reduce some of the damage. But please be careful, particularly around power lines and around fast-moving water where you can't really judge how much, how deep it is. And just keep in mind, too, sometimes you can have washouts in different places, whether that's the road or if you're just even going across your yard, that you may not know how deep that water is. So please be careful with that.
Dr. Jimmy, I got a question for you.
Sure.
So I'll preface this by saying I am getting older, and so if I've asked you this question before, I apologize for repeating it. last week I was in upstate New York helping take care of my mother, who's 92 years old. She takes a lot of different medications. Fortunately, my sister has a system worked out with an Alexa unit where we get reminders and that sort of thing. But one thing that struck me was one of the doses she took, the one pill was this teeny tiny little thing, and then the other one was like a horse pill. So my question is, what determines what size it is? Because you would think most drug manufacturers would want to make something as small as possible so it would be easy to be taken.
Yeah, that's a great question. One I get frequently, particularly when you sort of, like if you're treating somebody for hypertension and they require two medications and one of them is very small, the other one's very big, and they're like, what's the difference here? This one must be a lot stronger than the one that's smaller, the one that's larger being more strong. But it's not necessarily the case. So depending on the active ingredient, like if you look at all the, if you look at all medications, they're going to say the active ingredient, they're going to have some inactive ingredients. And most of the time that's things like methyl cellulose, which is just, that's the same material that's in plants, and things that keep that active ingredient in the state that it can pass through the GI tract down to the point where it needs to release it. And sometimes it needs to release it all at once. Sometimes it needs to release it over time. And then depending on what the active ingredient is, some of those are much, much easier to put in a form that can hold its shape. And the same thing with, some things are capsules for that reason, because they can't be in a solid form. They have to be in a liquid form. But it really does depend on the actual chemical. And some people say, well, I don't understand, why that would happen, or why can't you just make it a solid? If you think about it, the difference between, say, butter and olive oil. So olive oil, we can't really make that into a solid very easily. Now, we could under the right conditions and pressure, but you can't maintain that or ship it. That's the other thing about medications. They have to be stored for an appropriate amount of time so that they don't break down and they're active. But you can have the same therapeutic amount of medication that does the same thing in a big tablet as you can in a small tablet. It really just depends on that individual thing. The other thing I'll say about that too is sometimes I'll switch from one medication to another. Say, again, we'll stick with hypertension. And they'll say, why are you going from 20 to 240 milligrams? That seems like that's a big difference. So 20 milligrams of lisinopril to 240 of verapamil. Well, again, the dosage is not equal from medication to medication. It's specific to that one medication. So same kind of thing with antibiotics. It doesn't necessarily mean that, just because it's a higher number that you're taking of milligrams, that is a much more powerful or a stronger stronger dose of it. So you really have to look at the individual ones, because some medications, it's a very small amount. Thyroid medication is a good example, where the active ingredient is measured in micrograms or a thousandth of a gram, very small amount versus milligrams. So that's just a difference in medications, and you have to sort of just go with the flow. There are some medications, though, that are darn hard to take, like potassium is a good example. It is a big old, I usually say, hey, you're taking the horse pill, because it is truly an enormous pill that is hard to take for a lot of patients. And sometimes that does come into play. Certainly with pediatric patients, we have some of those issues, and sometimes there are liquid alternatives, but sometimes they're not. And another thing you need to keep in mind, not every medication can be crushed up. So your pharmacist is always a great person to ask about that when you pick up medications. Always a good question. That was Kevin Farrell, who's always there. And I don't think you have asked me that. So memory intact, at least for today, Kevin. Let's go to Bobby from Pontotoc. Good morning, Bobby.
How y'all doing? That woman, I ain't got much time left. I that woman that called in about cataract surgery a while ago, I didn't get her name, but tell her if she'll go to Wesson's Eye Center in Tupelo, Mississippi. It's in Gloucester Street in Tupelo, Mississippi. Says, talk to Dr. Charles, and he'll fix her up. I had the same problem, and he got done me a good job.
All right. There we have it. Yeah, that's always a good thing to share like that. And a lot of patients, I think, are really almost scared to talk to somebody else about something. And I usually tell them, hey, look, a second opinion is totally fine. And sometimes it is the comfort level of the physician, particularly when you start talking about surgeries. And one physician, for very good reasons, may not feel comfortable doing something another physician might. So I appreciate that, and we will certainly pass that on. I'm sure she's still listening, but that's great to share with them. All right, Bobby, thank you for that. We got a couple of minutes left. I got an email that we could probably tackle right here. So this is about chronic UTIs. I'm 74 years old and cannot get rid of chronic urinary tract infections. I'm currently on Cipro, which is horrible for me. I'm not sure exactly what the specifics are with that. Do you think my kidney stones, which I've had for over 40 years and have not been any trouble or removed, could be causing this in any way? So a lot of things could cause chronic UTIs, particularly in our female patients as you get older. And most of that has to do with the plumbing, with how well do you empty urine out of your bladder, and how is there any urine that is what we call reflux and going back up into the bladder. So typically it should only go one way. The kidney stones, usually that's much more of an upper urinary tract problem. So it's typically a problem at the kidney level. Sometimes it can obstruct the flow of urine from the kidney down to the bladder. But usually for just a simple bladder infection, it's not going to have any kind of increased risk. Now, it can cause an increased risk of that bladder infection then becoming infected upstream towards the kidney, and we call that pyelonephritis, and that's a much more significant infection that has to be treated most of the time by IV antibiotics. So, I would go to a urogynecologist or a urologist that specializes in this. There are some new techniques that can sort of bulk up the urethra, which is that tubing, if you want to think of it that way, from your bladder to the outside of your body. And sometimes they'll do some studies usually to see how well you empty your bladder. And if you're not emptying it as well, that could be the problem of bacteria just backing back up into your bladder and causing the infection. Because we always have bacteria in that area. So it's really hard to prevent that if you don't have the system working very well. And female patients get it because there's shorter distance to the bladder. And if you've had multiple children, it sort of weakens all those muscles in there over time and as you get older. Hey, I want to thank everybody for calling today. And again, stay safe. Southern Remedy is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at UMMC. Southern Remedy is produced by Kevin Farrell. You can tune in to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.